Yes, while Imam passed away and got martyred, Imam Hassan al-Askari, Imam Mahdi was an infant. So it was very strange for them to know that, okay, where from, what time was his birthday? These were the questions that actually made their minds busy a bit. But I think this kind of ambiguity is a sort of rahmah. We see that اختلاف أمتي رحمة in a hadith by the Holy Prophet. Sometimes changing of the views and viewpoints even is a case of Rahman blessing. You see, this is the case that people came with different questions, but the scholars, the elites of the society, the companions of the Imam actually were going to the different communities, explaining to them, no, Imam had this kid and this is the story and Imam is available. I mean, the whole issue was collected and people came to their own belief that, okay, Imam exists and Imam is absent from their eyes.
So we're going to have other misconceptions and questions for the next episodes. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us, and thank you, brother, for being here with me. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest glow?
It must be heaven.
Part 1.
May 15th, 1948. The last British ship had not yet faded away when Ben-Gurion announced the establishment of so-called State of Israel in a speech broadcast by the media.
For us, it is the most tragic moment in our history. Will be re-established the old United Nations and the Mandatory Power of England as a free Jewish commonwealth where all inheritance.
The skirmish began. Arab armies crossed over the borders to reach the battlefield in support of Palestinians. Finally, after a year of conflict on all fronts, they retreated, and contrary to expectations, the ground was prepared for the acceptance of the usurped government in the United Nations. May 15, 1948 became known as Nakba Day. The day when the occupiers finally put their seal on the Holy Land. But the truth of the matter is that Palestine was conquered by Zionist filmmakers for the first time in cinema frames. This documentary is a story of the occupation of Palestine in cinema pictures and the struggle and effort by Palestinian filmmakers to recapture their country through the lens. When the train passed the last curve, the city could be seen in the distance. The inventors of cinema had come to the east. The Lumiere brothers were the first passengers who got off the train at Khan Station. Pretty soon, the anchorages and the crowded markets the men scorched under the sun, and ancient shrines moved in front of the camera of the Lumieres. It was the most popular land in the world, the Holy Land, Palestine. For centuries, the most famous warriors in history had drawn their swords in the dream of ruling this land. But from that day, the war was dragged into the cinema frames. After the Lumiere brothers, Christian film production teams arrived one after the other to the land where Jesus Christ was once born, lived, and crucified. When the cameramen were making sneak peeks everywhere to find footprints of Jesus and were presenting a Christian narrative of Palestine, a new rival entered the scene and announced its bid for Palestine. Murray Rosenberg, a Jewish immigrant, made a 20-minute movie named The First Film of Palestine. Undoubtedly, the dream of Israel was born for the first time in this movie with the magic of cinema, and it moved before the greedy eyes of the Zionists. The First World War was devouring and ravaging the world like a monster, but the Zionists were lurking so they might be able to find some booty for themselves from the heart of all the destruction. When the war fronts were tied, the World Zionist Congress made a stunning proposal to the British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George. If Britain undertakes to support the Jewish immigration to Palestine, they will enter the United States into the war. Soon that the Germans, who were supporters of the Ottoman Empire, by sinking the ships belonging to Zionist merchants, forced the U.S. President Woodrow Wilson to enter the battle. A year later, when allies were at the gates of Al-Quds, Yaakov Ben Dov, a Jewish immigrant who had founded the Menorah Film Company, shot his first film. The movie depicts the historic arrival of General Allenby, the commander of the British Army, in Al-Quds on December 11, 1917. With the arrival of the Allies in Al-Quds, the 400-year-old reign of the Ottoman Empire on the city ended. Palestine came under the tutelage of Britain, and the Zionist dream finally came true. Only a month before the arrival of the Allies, a statement was issued in which Arthur James Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, announced England's support for establishing a Jewish national homeland in Palestine. In the declaration, which became known as Balfour, London pledged it will provide the necessary means for Jews' immigration to Palestine on the condition the newly arrived Jews are employed in lands that are not owned by any individual. The declaration was a beginning of efforts in the international arena to establish a so-called State of Israel. It is not an exaggeration if we say that the conditions of the Balfour Declaration became the manifesto of the Israeli cinema. Ben Dob, who is dubbed as a father of the Israeli cinema in collaboration with several other filmmakers in a project called Mirror of the Return of the Israeli People, immediately started making propaganda documentary films. Many of the films were ordered by the Jewish National Fund, an organization that was established in 1901 with the aim of buying land from Palestinians and, in a broader perspective, for the development of Jewish lands in Palestine. These movies also depicted the Arabs of Palestine in the form of primitive people, serfs, and without any national identity, who were wandering about in the desolate and barren desert. The model of the narrative structure of what later became known as the Israeli cinema is the product of that period. This structure narrated history like this. Jewish immigrants took root in an inhabited and abandoned territory, expanded it, and made it prosperous. Movies that announced the discovery of a lost paradise that had no owners. Hence, moviegoers all around the world watched the story of the Zionists like a big luck for the Palestinians. The migration that brought culture and wealth to the quote-unquote miserable land. On the other side of the world, Jewish capitalists who were fleeing the war and had entered the U.S. a little earlier and founded Hollywood started making films from the very first days that completed the narrative of the Zionist cinema. Legendary Hollywood producers, the Warner Brothers, Samuel Goldwyn, and Louis Mayer presented a fixed and dangerous stereotype of the hated Arabs in their movies. Wild and backward people, who soon became the most infamous characters of Hollywood. With the help of the silver screen, the image of the confrontation between educated Jewish immigrants and primitive Arab inhabitants occupied the historical memory of moviegoers all over the world. In the Middle East, Arabs, like many Eastern societies, got to know cinema from the 1920s. In the 1930s, cinema halls were established in all major cities of Palestine. But the way cinema entered the Palestinian society turned into a big issue. Most of the movies that were shown on the silver screens were Egyptian musical comedies. Superficial melodramas that exposed private romantic relationships to the public for the first time. Religious figures, not only in Palestine, but also in Syria, Egypt, and Jordan, constantly asked the authorities to stop the movies or at least censor them. Despite all of this, the cinema seemed insignificant compared to the great problems that Palestinians were dealing with. 10 years had passed since Palestine was Britain's tutelage. At the turn of the 1930s, an influx of Jewish migrants started from everywhere in the world towards Palestine, and the Arabs were slowly realizing that they were being trapped. It was during that period when Palestinian protests in the cities of Al-Quds and Jaffa turned bloody and the British army suppressed the Arab uprisings. Arab leaders showed up claiming they want to resolve the problem of the Palestinian people, but their presence was so ineffective that it was unclear whether they were going there to protect Al-Quds or to say goodbye to it. In 1935, Saudi King Abdulaziz bin Saud went to Al-Quds. The only thing that made this trip different was the presence of a Palestinian with his camera, Ibrahim Hassan Sarhan. Sarhan made a 20-minute movie of the event and started the Palestinian cinema. At that time, Sarhan and a few other passionate filmmakers experienced making movies again, a cinema that has no trace today except for the memories of the people and the notes printed in the newspapers back then. It looked like Palestinian cinema was being shaped, but the storm of events that soon reached Palestine shattered the dreams of the first generation of Palestinian filmmakers. The situation in Palestine worsened with the start of the Second World War. The Zionists were moving Jews from Eastern Europe and America to Palestine in droves. By the end of the war, the Jewish population had increased from 5% at the beginning of the 20th century to 30%. The increase in population coincided with the decline of Britain, which had suffered a huge loss in the heart of the war front. Britain, that once claimed that the sun never sets on the territory of its empire, turned into a toothless lion at the end of the war that was not even capable of protecting its smallest and closest colonies. Now, the maintenance of Palestine required at least 100,000 soldiers.
Part 1A.
The bankrupt and weak British Parliament immediately left the issue of Palestine to the United Nations.
I now declare open the first meeting of the United Nations Palestine Commission.
In 1947, the partition plan of Palestine was approved by the United Nations, and Palestine was divided between the Arabs and the Jews. But it was decided that the Zionists would not have the right to form any government before British forces leave Palestine. It was the golden opportunity the Zionists had been looking for years. From that time on, the Zionist terrorist groups drove the final nail in the coffin of the British Empire with numerous bombings and attacks on British soldiers. May 14th, 1948, the last British ship had not faded away yet when Ben-Gurion announced the existence of Israel in a speech broadcasted by the media.
From the Jewish homeland, Palestine, and the Jewish Brigade,
the skirmish started. Israel occupied Haifa, and pretty soon the cities of Safa and Acre fell. After the bombardment of Jaffa, Sarhan and his friends left all their movies and videos among the blood and fire and ran away. Finally, on May 15, 1948, Israel attacked Al-Quds. On the same day, the Arab armies entered Palestine. Despite the initial victories, the Arabs eventually retreated on all fronts. With the loss of more lands, the number of displaced persons increased by the day. Finally, after a year of conflict, in May of 1949, the Arab countries that rushed to the rescue of the Palestinians surrendered one after the other. The countries inevitably signed the ceasefire agreement. The signing of the agreements paved the way for the acceptance of the usurped government in the United Nations. When the life of the Palestinian community as a political and social entity came to an end, an absolute silence prevailed, a silence of anger and guilty conscience. Life in the coastal cities almost disappeared, and half of the Palestinian citizens became homeless and refugees. About 900,000 displaced people. For years, the refugee ideology dominated the Palestinian culture. Refugees are always pulled here and there, but remain in a temporary state. Memory and nostalgia are a way to understand the history of Palestine. A repressed memory that moves to the subconscious mind like a mental injury and disrupts the sequence of time. The past replaces the present, and the future finds meaning only in the form of a return to the past, a history that endlessly repeats the past that resembles paradise and its collapse. While the Palestinians were shackled with silence, the new storytellers of the Arab world emerged from Egypt. A group known as the Free Officers stage a coup against King Farouk of Egypt. Mohamed Naguib was in the forefront, but everyone knew that the mastermind was none other than Gamal Abdel Nasser, a person who quickly managed to reach the presidency. In a brave move, Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal. The decree had far-reaching and dramatic consequences. Since 1948, Western countries sought to bolster the Israeli regime, and the Suez Canal witnessed the daily traffic of foreign ships and arms. Behind the decree by Nasser, it had many untold stories for the Palestinians. The first dramatic consequence of the brave move happened 3 months later. On October 29th, Israel attacked Egypt and occupied the Sinai Peninsula with the help of French and British forces. The Soviet Union supported Nasser and entered the Egyptian battlefield and stood up against France and England. Finally, Britain and France signed a peace agreement and the Israeli soldiers had to retreat. Thus, Nasser reached the peak of his popularity. He spread his story all over the Arab world. The story of the United Arab Ummah, or nation. For many years, the Arabs had pinned their hopes on Gamal Abdel Nasser, but perhaps most of all, the Palestinian refugees were hopeful about Nasser. The dream of a united Arab nation was meaningless without the freedom of Palestine.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
نفس اجدهاست مارگیر خود انسانه اول از همه خود انسان از بین بره بعد هم مردم ملت پار میکنه
مولانا the famous Persian poet states our soul and self are like a snake and we are like snake charmers this means that if we do not control the desires of the soul we will be perished by the snake of the soul Maulana continues, if you don't like to be killed by the snake of the soul, so it's better to leave it in the snow, which is away from the temptations of the world. In other words, temptations, desires, and attractions of the world make your soul hot and proud, and they will perish you. Once a dervish stated, Prophet Muhammad ascended to the heavens on the night of Mi'raj and then got back to earth to guide his people. If I was in the place of Prophet Muhammad, I would never get back to earth and would stay in the heavens. This sentence of the dervish means that Prophet Muhammad made a great sacrifice to get back to earth and help his people to grow spiritually. This shows the great status of Prophet Muhammad.
Music
Thank you very much, dear listeners of Arab English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.ir Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Under an opaque policy condemned as discriminatory and inhumane, the British government has refused dozens of visas for children of migrant single mothers. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. An investigation revealed Britain's Home Office is systematically barring young children from joining their mothers in Britain, despite extensive proof that the women are their primary caregivers. Under an opaque policy condemned as discriminatory and inhumane, the British government has refused dozens of visas for children of migrant single mothers, many of whom came to work in the National Health Service or social care, saying there are no compelling reasons to grant them a visa. The women left their children, some as young as 2 years old, in the temporary care of relatives or friends, while they moved to Britain from countries like Zimbabwe, Zambia, Kenya, South Africa, and India. They say before leaving their country, they had been reassured by their employers that their children would be able to follow them to Britain, in line with current immigration rules permitting healthcare workers to bring close family members to Britain. But when they applied for their children's visas, their applications were turned down. In refusal letters seen by The Guardian, the Home Office questioned why the children could not stay permanently with their grandparents or other relatives. In other cases, it said there was no reason why they could not go to live with their fathers, even though their mothers had sole custody or their fathers had not seen the children for years. Many of the letters addressed directly to the children conclude, "It was your mother's personal decision to depart for the United Kingdom, and you have not provided sufficient evidence to grant your visa on serious or compelling grounds." The cases have come to light weeks after the government announced a plan to slash immigration by placing restrictions on the dependents of migrants' healthcare workers. Under controversial rules expected to be introduced this spring, care workers coming to the United Kingdom will be barred from bringing their family members to Britain, while other healthcare workers will have to earn £29,000 a year, rising to £38,700 a year in 2025 to be permitted to do so. But scores of applications from such workers are already being quietly refused. The Guardian has examined 10 cases and been alerted to 140 more, where migrant women or single mothers have had visas for children denied in the past 18 months. The applications for visas have not been rejected because the Home Office doubts they are genuine or that the women are the children's primary caregivers. Instead, they have been refused under a Home Office rule that a child may only be given a visa if both parents are living in the United Kingdom, unless the parent living in England has sole responsibility. The policy means single parents are required to prove not only that they have sole custody, but that the other parent is not involved in their child's upbringing, something experts say can be hard to do. If the sole responsibility threshold is not met, the Home Office can still grant applications if it believes there are compelling or compassionate grounds for doing so. But as yet, it has declined to do so in the women's cases investigated by The Guardian, which has seen extensive evidence to support the mothers' claims that they are their children's sole caregivers. In many cases, the women gave the Home Office court documents and custody papers proving they were the sole custodian of the child, as well as bank statements, insurance policies, photographs and letters of support from schools, doctors and church leaders. Many also have signed consent letters from their children's fathers, but in some cases this has been used against them. One mother, Yeti, had a visa for her 6-year-old daughter denied. The care worker from Zambia says she and the girl's father separated when she was pregnant, and she has always been her sole caregiver. Shortly after she arrived in Britain in March, Yeti, 36 years old, submitted an application for a child to join her. She supplied documents including a court order linked to her separation and an affidavit from the girl's father saying it would be in the child's best interest to come to Britain. But the Home Office refused the child a visa, saying the fact that her father had provided a consent letter was proof he was still in her life and could therefore look after her. Getty said the separation had taken a huge toll, adding, "My daughter asks me every day when her papers are going to be ready. I have to be honest with her and tell her I'm still waiting for the papers. She's only used to living with me. It's really, really hard." In another case, a National Health Service nurse who provided the Home Office with a court document proving she had sole custody for her two daughters, aged 4 and 13, was told there were no serious or compelling reasons why the girls needed to join her in Britain. She said, "It's heartbreaking. How can I sleep at night? I am the mother of the children and I have always looked after them."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, my guest speaker as always. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to business according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, generally, Sheikh Javid, what's the view on wearing American clothes?
Well, and to be honest, according to the religious authorities, there is no objection to wearing clothes made in countries like the United States of America or non-Muslim countries, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that, for example, these clothes are made by the enemies of Islam does not affect the permissibility of wearing such clothes, okay? And however, you know, if wearing clothes, American clothes, let's say the example you gave, leads to some kind of promoting the un-Islamic culture or the culture which is diametrically opposed to Islam, and that's the culture of the enemy, and if it leads to strengthening the economies, which is in turn used in colonizing and exploiting Muslim countries, so in that case, it is problematic.
Mm.
And it's not even permissible to wear such clothes which would help those imperial powers or imperialistic countries to further to get further strengthened and to get further the chance to attack Muslims or to harm Muslims by the way they by the their way of that by their culture and by their means available to them.
Shastavi, depending on where you work or who you work with, people in fact wear in different styles. Sometimes we have formal dress or dress code, and sometimes people wear casually. All right. You know, in some settings, like for example, banks, if you're working for them, you know, you are required to wear ties. Or for some certain or few ceremonies, you need to wear neckties.
Yes.
Or bows, let's say. Well, I mean, my question is that, is it permissible to wear such things like a tie or a necktie or whatever?
Well, that's a good question. When it comes to a tie or necktie, you know, the scholars are somehow polarized. They have different opinions. For example, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei is of the view that it's not permissible for a Muslim to wear a necktie because he will look like a non-Muslim, a non-Muslim. And that necktie is something that suggests crucifixion, you know. It will label you as someone who believes in Christianity or believes in the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. That's not what we stand for. That's not what Muslims believe in. But when you wear that necktie, you are indirectly telling them that you believe in such a thing. Okay? That's why many religious scholars, as far as I know, have said that it is not permissible to wear a necktie because you look like those non-Muslims. And it's very it's forbidden for a Muslim to make himself look and simulate Islamic non-Muslim culture, non-Muslim way of life, non-Muslim way of clothing.
Okay. But what about suits?
But of course, there is no problem in wearing suits. As I was trying to say that, okay, some scholars nevertheless believe that it doesn't mean that when you are wearing a necktie, you are actually you are presenting yourself as a non-Muslim. No. So the scholars differ in their opinion. So according to Ayatollah Sistani, wearing a necktie is permissible. Okay. So everyone has to follow his own mujtahid in such matters. It's not a big deal. It's not a big issue. Of course, wearing necktie can be forbidden. It can be allowable, permissible, depending on who you follow. Okay.
Okay.
And of course, when it comes to wearing a suit, it is quite permissible to wear it.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah. Oh Allah, don't let me go astray, 'cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Shastra with our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to business according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Shastra, is it permissible for women to be among those people, those individuals, who, for example, offer welcome or offer flowers in some ceremonies held by administrations and the like, justifying it as demonstrating freedom and respect for women in Islamic countries or societies?
You're right. it does not make sense to invite women to participate in ceremonies to welcome foreigners, you know. And it doesn't mean, actually it does not demonstrate that when, for example, where women are invited to participate in such ceremonies, then it means that you are giving freedom and liberty to women, and you are respecting the rights of women. No, of course, if it leads to vile consequences and promotion of un-Islamic culture, according to our Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, it is not permissible to do such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we see that it does sometimes constitute such vile consequences, because those who, for example, go to the airport, the ladies who go to the, we see that sometimes they shake hands with non-mahram men, and of course that's one of the vile consequences of women carrying flowers and welcoming people from coming from abroad.
I see. Is it permissible, Sheikh Javed, to wear items of clothing bearing the advertisement of alcoholic drinks?
It is not permissible under any circumstances. It's forbidden to wear any clothing, any item of clothing that promotes indecency. And one of the manifestations of indecency is alcoholic beverages.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And I've seen a lot of people, including Muslims, in fact, say Merry Christmas to some other people, be it Jews or Christians. Well, I mean, that is it permissible for Muslims to actually use such expressions at all?
Well, according to the religious authorities, it's said, if it is said, then if it means confirmation of their beliefs and practices, it's not permissible, because we are not confirming them in their beliefs and their practices. If congratulating them means confirming their beliefs, confirming and affirming what they are believing in, then it's not permissible.
Like,
okay.
I mean, like, if you congratulate somebody on the birthday of Jesus Christ, what's the matter with it?
In and of itself, there's no problem, okay? Mm-hmm. If you say, okay, yes, you just congratulate someone on the birthday, because we also believe in the prophet Jesus.
Exactly,
yeah.
That's the point.
So we are also happy on that day because of the birth of the prophet Jesus. And there is no problem in and of itself.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. And thank you, my dear listeners, for joining us or tuning in to the radio, to IRIB English Radio, for the program Islamic Laws, in which we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws regarding business according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun La ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun La ilaha illahum وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.